Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullen. Welcome back to another Real Conversation. Going to have a conversation with one of my partners today here, Jay Van Sciver, who's been around the block. He and I actually went to the same college. He was a chemistry major. That's why some of you have figured out that Jay, when he speaks about ideas on the call, which is one of our new products, he speaks specifically and chemically. Jay, I appreciate all that knowledge that you've built over the years. You're one of the few people that covers the entire waterfront and has that go-anywhere strategy in industrials, because a lot of things that people can't characterize any other way, they throw into your bucket, so they get called industrials. But you do a damn good job from SPACs to, you know, this Insperity idea most recently to going all over the place, and I think people enjoy that about your process too. So looking forward to getting into that. Thanks for making some time here in the middle of the day.
Absolutely. It's an interesting sector.
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, you make things interesting to me that I didn't know were interesting. So let's do that. Like, how do you, let's just take it from a process perspective first. I think my conversation with Tobin was excellent in that regard. You can go anywhere in an industrial. So where, how do you start? When you say, okay, look, I'm looking for a new idea, what am I going to do here next?
Well, I think one thing we like to look at is the fleet that's out there. Like, what is the installed base of whatever that's operating. So in the case, we have a set of slides going through this, but like we look at the shipbuilding industry, like if all of the ships are old or in need of replacement, or there's a regulation that's driving replacement, you'll tend to see a surge in demand for whatever piece of equipment that is. And on the other side, after they've all been replaced, oftentimes they look, they can end up being value traps where you have inflated results and very little on the other side. And then occasionally, like in the case of Yes, energy, you have an actual structural shift or a secular shift where there's a new market or major change underway. Automation, some sensors, there are some categories that fit that as well. But that's generally one of the best ways to whack up the sector, I think. You know, sort of what's old, what's new, what needs to be replaced.
But to come to those thoughts or conclusions, and I think this is where a lot of people get lost, you can get lost in our own brain pretty quickly. They're thematic. They're like, well, this feels, it's the worst word in investing. It feels like this. There should be no feel to this. I mean, aren't these just long time series and cycles?
Yes. If you get the cycle right, you used to say with the dollar, if you get the dollar right, you're going to get a lot of other things right.
Yeah.
If you get the cycle right, you're going to get a lot of these names right. If you get the cycle wrong, you're going to get absolutely run over. And it's a sector where valuation is often misleading, where, something looks like a high multiple or it looks like a low multiple.
Right.
But usually you want to buy them when they're losing money. That's the best time in the cycle. And they have a very high multiple.
Well, that's something that people need to learn that lesson, right? You buy cyclical because it's expensive, and you sell it because it looks cheap. Can you explain that very basic thing, like, quickly so that people understand what that means?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're in an industry where somebody made a law that you have to buy widgets, right? You're going to sell a lot of widgets that year, and you're going to print money. And people are going to look at your stock and be like, oh, my God, it's only trading at 2x earnings. It's cheap. And it's like, no, it's not cheap. You're about to sell no widgets because, the law expires or whatever it is. So in our sector, very often, low multiples or compressed multiples, as we call them, are contraindicators. They're things that you want to worry about. And we have ways of adjusting for that. So like when we did the canning industry, my favorite one was we did EV, enterprise value per can of capacity. But there are a lot of metrics like that we can create to take that cyclicality out and value the business independent of, sort of the sine wave of profitability that ripples through the sector.
Yeah, the two most recent examples I think that everybody would be familiar with or should be that you made long calls on were FedEx and CAT. Like when you first started saying, hey, look, I like these things, they looked quote unquote expensive, but expensive on the wrong earnings numbers. As the cycle comes their way, the earnings numbers obviously grow into where the stock price is. So those were great calls and good examples of a go anywhere strategy. I mean, obviously FedEx and CAT are two different things. Let's get into your process on that, like, and just go by slide number how you want to articulate it.
Sure. I mean, I think on the second slide, we have the shipbuilding cycle, which is my favorite cycle.
If you can have of course it is. Why the hell is this your favorite cycle? Is it?
Everyone needs a favorite cycle. You need to figure that out. It needs to be in your like Tinder profile or whatever.
Does that start in 1940, that chart? Yeah, it does start in 1940. Yeah. That's why you like it. It's just super long.
It's I like historical context, you know, because very often in our sector, what's driving activity today is something that happened like 30 years ago. And my bias, when I started in this industry, I worked for a guy who had been an industrials analyst for 60 years. Like he was literally in his mid 80s. I was at Brown Brothers Harriman, you know, which had a lot of these kind of people, who, you know, because, you know, Brown Brothers Harriman is featured on Mad Men as a contemporary company, right? Like it's literally, there's a character, it was shocking to me that it was like, oh my God, I went there. But it was a great place to start and learn because I got to be basically apprentice to this guy who was also from Yale or whatever. But he was, you know, a person who was like, he would look at, you know, a bunch of like air conditioners and his attitude was like, oh, I remember when those were installed, you know, and it'd be like, John, that was in like 1978. It's like, I know I was there, you know, and that's, that's, I think, a helpful perspective. So a lot of cycles are actually kicked off by World War II, which is one of the reasons I love Neil Howe's work, is because so much of this is from the last great fourth turning, right? You have this, you have all this industrial infrastructure go into building ships, right? So you had all these ships. What happened to them? They were converted to the commercial fleet. You had a lot of commercial fleet shipping. So you see that bump up for World War II on the far left in the 40s, but ships, because of salt water and steel and electrolysis and a lot of other things, only last for about 30 years. That's a long time to keep a ship going. So you get a replacement cycle. It's a little squishier than the first peak. And then you get another replacement cycle that's kind of the China WTO entry, iron ore shipping bubble. And nobody talks about the Baltic Dry anymore, but if you've been around, you might remember that. And that was actually a short we did in real time. I joined Hedgeye at our launch short. This is actually from our launch short presentation. It's updated. But shorting shipbuilding as a really clear cycle. Samsung Heavy was the one there. And it's been, at first it was a terrible short. That made me feel awkward because I was trying to launch this vertical into like my process example was not that great. But now it looks fantastic. If you look at Samsung Heavy, it's played out really quite nicely. But I think what we look for, like in trucking, we've done two trucking cycles in the last 8 years, looking at the fleet age and emissions and labor availability. There are different cycle drivers for each industry. This one just happens to be very long because they're long-lived assets.
So this is this for people, and I like to tie, because there are a lot of people here that are well aware of our macro process. When I say it's go anywhere, we're looking at the time series of the cycle for 50 different countries. And what you're looking at is the cycle of the cycle for any of the subsectors of your universe within that global macro cycle, correct?
Yeah, and we have a slide on like what I think people get wrong about industrials is they are all incredibly specific. Like you have to get into the weeds on each. Like you want to do air conditioners, you got to look at the air conditioner fleet. You want to do trucks, you got to look at the fleet in Europe, the United States, South America. Like there are, it is very specific. It's very data intensive. But if you can lay it out clearly, it becomes pretty obvious. Like you wanted to buy ships in 2002, right? Because not only the macro backdrop of China entering WTO, you had trade, it's a growth industry, but also just the ships are super old. People are going to have to replace them. So the second part of the process I think is very important is industry structure. And I think I picked on the next slide Brinks, which is just the largest armored truck. The other thing we can look for is a secular trend, right? So occasionally we'll see, something that's just new, right? Like, guess what? You know, people aren't building coal power plants anymore. That's secular. That's not going to turn around because they're now actually more expensive than some of the intermittent capacity, right? So the other thing, if we don't get the cycle right, occasionally what we're looking for is a secular shift.
Yeah.
In this case, battery storage, which is a name I guess I was thinking about because it's up today, which is Eos Energy, which was a SPAC we did for grid battery storage. This is a newish industry. This is a secular change within how the grid architecture will be. These are much rarer, but they can oftentimes be really good alpha opportunities. And the other cool thing is when I'm 80 years old and all these batteries are getting replaced, I can say like, oh, I remember when they installed those batteries with all that solar capacity in California, I can become the person I once worked for.
That's great. But you don't have to be the old guy. I mean, you just have to be a student of history, to be clear. I think that often happens on Wall Street when people tell me, like, I'm actually still at 45 years old, relatively young in terms of certainly against the old Wall strategist. And some people will just, like, you know, with no humility whatsoever, just say, young man, you weren't here during the last cycle. And it's like, dude, I read a book every 10 days to make sure I'm sharp on what happened back then. Can you tell me, do you even have a pulse at this point? You know, as you know, at the age of 71, most men are neurologically losing it anyway, so I feel pretty good about those types. But again, it is what it is. Isn't it just being, you're basically a historian. You can't say there's a new regime or say this about any cycle unless you've studied the history of the cycle. Then you start to do your work.
Yeah, the historian, futurist, statistician, and kind of an investment banker, right? Like, you're always thinking about how things fit together, whatever it is. Like, we're trying to do all of those things, at once. And what's fun about industrials, unlike maybe healthcare, where things actually change, like trucking, shipping, railroads, armored cars, right? They don't really change, right? Like, they change, but not really, right?
Well, why don't you do armored cars? Well, people do think that's going to change. People are short Brinks because they think cash is gone forever. Therefore, you don't need an armored trunk or armored car with cash in it.
Yeah, I kept calling it an armored car too, but that's what you get when you're like Al Capone. It's armored trucks. I chose looking at them for sale on Auto Trader. You can buy a used armored, Mercedes from some dictator. It's a great value. I think, what makes an armored car company valuable is the same thing that makes a uniform services company valuable or a pest control company valuable or any of these route-based services, where what matters is how dense your route is. Like, if I'm an armored car company and I have to drive to Canada and back from Connecticut to pick up the cash, there's no way I'm going to be able to charge and make that value proposition for the customer. So what you have to do is have a tight local route with a lot of stops. And once you have that tight local route with a lot of stops, your cost per stop comes down. And then you, can compete on price and have a sustainable competitive advantage. Like, nobody can ever underprice you because you have all of the, pickups in a given shopping center or whatever place needs cash picked up. And, they might, the reality is everyone's worried they're going to get rid of cash, but there are all these laws that are passed that preclude people not accepting cash, retailers not accepting cash, restaurants not accepting cash, because even though probably most of the people listening to this podcast are, in the context of America, quite wealthy, something like a quarter of the population is either unbanked or underbanked. A lot of people are paid in cash, and credit cards for us are a way to earn points, whereas for a lot of people, they're a way to incur late fees and penalties. So New York, for example, has a law that restaurants and retail locations have to accept cash, because otherwise it would be very regressive. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you're going to see cash go anywhere. And cash management, actually, not only is it not going anywhere, it's growing. It's actually been a growth industry. And these, outsourcing of cash management, I think, is a really interesting business that's just not priced into Brinks, right? So it's also an industry where, I think on the next slide, we actually have the consolidation in that industry. And what you had initially was a very fragmented, set of competitors. And Brinks has kind of gobbled them up and gotten bigger and organically grown faster. So once you have scale, once you have routes that are dense with a lot of customers, you kind of become the dominant player, and basically winners keep winning. So I think this is a pretty interesting industry structure advantage that they've developed. Industry structure is important because it tells you who's actually going to be profitable, right? You're a small armored car truck company competing against Brinks. You're going to have a very, very hard time, coming in with a lower cost.
Yeah, that, for anybody, and please follow along, like, have long-term charts when Jay's speaking, 5, 10, 30 all-time charts. because then you can see something like Brinks, which you just made a bullish call on, and what we would call this is a phase transition from bearish to bullish. And what Jay said initially is like, look, if you look at this chart right now, you're going to think it looks like an airline stock, but guess what? It's not an airline. And that's it's an amazing thing because this stock at the beginning of the year was at $95. You came onto it a lot lower than that, and the thing literally won't have a down day since you started explaining this. And that's a very valuable thing to people, is to have something asymmetric in their portfolio. If I take 10 of any analyst at Hedgeye's ideas and I wanted asymmetry to be the result amongst those 10 ideas, or something that was, again, you know, idiosyncratic would be another word that would come to mind, I would pick Jay Van Sciver 100% of the time, because he has the widest waterfront in terms of where it can go. He can go from zinc batteries or EOS Energy to Brinks to Insperity. And that's called diversification. It's called, you know, a lot of the words that I just used. So that thing really, you put that thing on people's radar most recently. So nice job with that. BCO, to a lot of people, might have been a boring stock, but it's been rip-roaring fun. In a down market, it's gone straight up.
We do boring well at Hedgeye Industrials.
Yeah, you do very boring.
We love boring.
BCO boring was good. What else you got on those slides?
I have no idea, but I'm sure they're great.
I just go to the next one.
Yeah, just go to the next slide. I'll talk about it.
It's like a teleprompter.
Oh, yeah. So the last part is valuation, right? So valuation is, I think, more than at any other time in my career. Like, I think in the early aughts, you could buy things at like 5x EBITDA, and they would just get an LBO offer, or at least an LBO rumor, and it would work. But in this market, valuation is... Yeah, it's just a liability. I mean, come on, like Bausch & Lomb and stuff like that. I think probably some of those still pay for the house I'm in. But the reality is that, like, it's not always true. Like, when you're talking about asymmetry, right, if you have an undervalued company, you have potentially a loaded spring or whatever you want to think about. And it can just keep compressing, like, unless you have some good reason for it to, you know, unwind. And, you know, FedEx, I think, is a great example of that, right, where it just kept getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for a long time because people thought that Amazon was going to come in and ruin the FedEx franchise, which is finally a kind of a silly thing to think, because it would actually be cheaper for Amazon just to buy FedEx. But, you know, that's, you get these negative narratives, you get extreme valuation moves, and they can just keep on going, right? Like, there's no reason it has to stop. And actually, the pandemic in the case of FedEx was a great... was a great catalyst, right? Because it canceled all these airline flights and all of the competitive belly space on commercial airlines went away. So suddenly you had an inadequate air cargo, and FedEx, which is basically a cargo airline, was in, you know, the catbird seat. Like, it was, you know, able to get quite a bit of pricing and have a lot less competition, you know, for its market. And that's a great, you know, setup. It actually took a long time, even though we had really good data, for it to play out, for that valuation reversal to happen. So in general, like, process-wise, we try and get the cycle right. We want to be on the right side of industry structure, and we want to make sure that there's alpha there, that there's that there is a valuation opportunity that's being missed, not because it's, like, you know, going to be a catalyst by itself, like, oh, it's the cheapest it's been, but because when you have a really good catalyst, like for Brinks, like, you can say it's cheap, but, you know, now that potentially you have a vaccine and people are going to start to anticipate a vaccine and what that means for retail and people going to concerts and other cash venues, you end up with a lot, you know, a potential upside catalyst as you get into the first half of next year.
Hmm. Yeah, that I think that's something, again, that people might struggle with. Again, you look at a stock like that. I mean, on the pandemic stock market crash, that thing went below $100 a share. I mean, it was just sitting there waiting for you to buy it. And, you know, maybe not as exciting as people's favorite, whatever, software as a service company, but the return has been a lot higher. And that's not every software company, but you know what I'm saying. You know, does that annoy you? Yeah, I know it annoys you, so why don't I just tee you up for that? You've had a lot of industrial companies that have now positioned themselves as something as a service or as a play on hydrogen, or as a play on this or on that. How much of the, we're the new secular shiny lure, Jay, that you should be looking at, how much bullshit factor is there in that arena?
It is spectacular to see a lot of these traditional, I mean, the, The one that gets me the most, I'll just throw this out here, is Cummins, which makes diesel engines. They make frack engines. They literally make frack engines, like a topic of a presidential debate about how bad it is for the environment. And if you look at who owns Cummins, it's dominated by ESG holders, these, you know, environmental, social, and governance holders, as though, you know, it's somehow by creating diesel engines saving the planet. I don't quite get it. But the other thing that they've done, because I think they know that they're in the way of a very painful narrative of basic, well, they're in the way of like six painful narratives: electrification of medium duty trucks, potential electrification of heavy duty trucks, or at least, the vertical integration. So a lot of truck OEMs are now making their own diesel engines, right? So they're in a mess of bad, narratives and bad business trends. Let's just be, you know, clear about that. And what they start doing is talking about Hydrogen Day and how they're going to make hydrogen, you know, fuel cell trucks. And you think, what are you talking about? You're one of the largest diesel engine makers on the planet. like a comet coming and hitting your planet or coming and hitting your factories would be less destructive than hydrogen, right? But you're telling us that hydrogen is a good thing. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
But people believe it, man. Like, I'm looking at this Cummins chart, CMI, and you'd think that it was FedEx. I mean, it actually looks a lot like FedEx in terms of where it just went from the markets crashed out lows. Like, people are seemingly willing to believe narratives much more than numbers. How much of that is institutional belief or need to believe? You know, ESG is a thing. So flows, capitals flow into what are considered ESG investments. Jay just told you it's not ESG. It's the opposite of ESG. So you got that institutional side. But then you have the retail community of 50, 60, 70 million, you know, Robin Hoodie type accounts that really want to hear something cool like Nikola or we're a hydrogen company at Cummins. I think Hydrogen Day they hosted this week, maybe. I think I saw that somewhere.
So what are the problems with being an ESG investors is that almost every activity a human engages in is bad for the environment, right? Like, there's very little you can actually do. You know, you can plant a tree, I guess. Like, I mean, there are, like, you can buy and preserve land, but, like, most economically profitable activity involves moving stuff, labor, you know, electricity, things that are not very ESG. So what happens to all of this ESG money is it has very few outlets in which it can go, right? So one of the things that explains, I think, Nikola is so stupid. Nikola has no factory. They make no trucks. They don't even have any, they don't have a founder, CEO anymore. It's the dumbest thing I've seen. You know, there's still people who hold it, I think, because there are so few alternatives for ESG money, which, you know, you can say, like, well, that's very inefficient. I hate that. Or you can say, hey, I'll bet these grid batteries are going to get a lot of money because there's nothing else for these idiots to buy. And this is pretty good. Like, this actually probably is good for the environment. You know,
so it's doubly good. I mean, like, when you find, and let's just go through two of these, because there, and by the way, if you have questions for Jay, pop them in the queue. I'll ask the ones that are getting voted up most likely. But obviously, the questions that are already in there right now are the things that have really worked for you this week: Mountain Pass, and which you've mentioned a couple times, EOS, which, you know, the former tickers were FVAC and BMRG. They're both SPACs. For those of you that don't know, now the ticker for Mountain Pass is MP. They've de-SPACed, and for B. Riley, the BMRG ticker is now EOSE. Okay, so here you have things that I guess both stocks, rare earths in the case of Mountain Pass, and you've already addressed, you know, zinc batteries, for example. Those would, if you have to have something in an ESG fund, they're actually things, real things, and that's part of the flow. Like, can't they get over, can people get overly confident in those things, in as much as they, if they're going to buy things that aren't true or don't exist, why wouldn't they buy something that's real?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. that's where we are. And, you know, you can complain. So I think, like you were paid on your P&L. I spent 5 years on a prop desk, right? Like, I have very few, like, I don't care. Like, you know, you get paid for winning, right? That's our job. And I may not love the fact as a human being that people are plowing money into inefficient ends. At the same time, our job is to generate alpha, and that's a really interesting anomaly that's around in the market, that, you know, all of this ESG crap is going to do pretty well. It's going to be a tough short, as I'm surprised. So I mean, part of the thesis in Cummins is that it's not ESG and it's completely ridiculous. I'm losing on that, right? This trend is so powerful as a driver of capital flows that even something as dumb as the largest diesel engine maker in the Western world is considered ESG, and hard to bet against, because, I mean, they literally have a defeat device investigation. Are you kidding me? Like, how do you have a defeat device? Like, that's what, you know, for those who don't know, VW, you know, that big scandal with Dieselgate was about them putting defeat devices on their engines so they actually made, you know, so they could comply with the regulations for emissions. Cummins has disclosed that in their, you know, SEC filings, and yet people, ESG money still flows there. But that's the world in which we live. That's the market we have. You don't fight with the army you want. You fight with the army. There's some quote like that. You know, that's the environment we're in. So we're going to go with that, with things like that are good. I'm also not willing to buy bad things or overvalued things. Like, that's just not my, I'm not going to be that capital allocator. So, you know, when we see things that are pretty cool that fit this model, that, you know, maybe are a little more risky, but are less risky now because we have this backdrop of all of this social money looking for an outlet, I think it's a compelling trend to play.
Yeah, it is. And let's just get into some of these questions, because they're gonna come to the fore anyway. Avery from California is asking, and this is a really important question, because people do have some battle scars on what this company was known to be. And that's, again, on what is now called Mountain Pass. What structural changes have taken place so that Mountain Pass or MP doesn't end up like MolyCorp?
So MolyCorp is a fraud. I mean, they were sued for being a fraud. So they also had a bunch of other crap. There's so many problems with Mountain Pass. We do a lot of field work, so I find it's really helpful to talk to, not inappropriately, but like ex-employees or, you know, people who were sort of on the ground and knew what was going on. And so one of the things MolyCorp did is they focused on cerium, which is, you know, conceivably the least, like, if you were going to choose the least valuable rare earth, that's the one you would go with, right? And secondly, even the rare earths that go into rare earth magnets, when MolyCorp was sort of a hot stock, it was kind of the wrong time. So timing matters, right? You know, I think that's true for grid batteries. I think that's true for rare earths, right? They were just 5 years too early for the market for electric cars and things like that to really see the, you know, rare earths that go into rare earth magnets come to dominate the value picture. And secondly, like, there was a, like, they would put out these press releases that they found something else that was just, you know, designed to kind of goose the stock. You know, I think they got into being a stock promotion scheme as opposed to being an operating company. And I think the thing that makes me feel the best about Mountain Pass in general is who's running it. And it's very rare to have high caliber people running a mining company. It's kind of like, you know, synonym, what is it? A liar standing next to a hole, right? These are people who are coming in who are surprising that they're there. I think they are genuinely driven by the mission of the U.S. strategic vulnerability with respect to China on rare earths. And you're seeing defense money flow into that, which you did not see in the last round. So, you know, millions of dollars announced this week, and probably much more than that for heavy rare earths from earlier in the year under an undisclosed project. So if you ask them, hey, how much did the government give you for heavy rare earth mining? They'll say, I can't talk about that. And that's probably true. And then there's another element to this that I think that management team is very aware of, is just how dirty and finally inhumane rare earth mining in China is. There is a problem with in rare earth mining that you end up with a lot of dangerous and radioactive waste products, and they cause things like bone cancer, which is a terrible disease, right? So in China, around these mines, there are a lot of sick people and a lot of people who will be sick because this stuff hasn't been, the tailings and residue of the mining has just been dumped into lakes. Like, it's completely ridiculous. So if you can clean that up, that's also, I think, a very attractive and important mission. You know, MP, when you go through it, first the deposit itself has fewer byproducts that are very dangerous, like thorium, right? And then secondly, they're using a dry tailings process, which is a little more expensive, but it keeps, you don't end up with these, you know, lakes and pools filled with incredibly toxic elements and byproducts. So I admire what they're doing in that sense. I think it's a good mission.
Yeah, I think there. I mean, the word mission with Mountain Pass is really an interesting one because it's appropriate. I mean, if for anyone who owns a stock or needs to, and by the way, there's plenty of upside. Jay will talk about that. You know, go to MP Materials, which is their website, and you'll see they've taken a considerable amount of care and time to rebrand this company. American flags on everybody's shoulders. You know, there's a mission. You know, to get to that better way. It's about the future of the supply chain. I thought that. I think his name is Michael Rosenthal, the COO, did a very good job. It's a young company. Latinsky, the CEO, is also, you know, call him young. I think he's my age, not that young. But but it's different. You know, it's an exciting story, really. It's an exciting and uniquely American story. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they think about branding the company? And, by the way, how the Department of Defense quite likes them branding the company as what it is, which is an American supply chain.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's probably easiest to start in China and why China wanted a rare earth monopoly, right? So currently, and that wasn't always true, but, you know, in maybe the last 20, 30 years, China took control of the rare earth supply chain because they didn't put in regulations, which are expensive, to deal with these byproducts, right? So they were willing to pollute in a way you wouldn't want anybody to pollute in the U.S. And as a result, they ended up with basically 100% of the rare earth production in the world. And there was actually a method to that. It wasn't just, oh, I want to destroy my environment. What they wanted was the downstream applications of those rare earths, right? So there's a lot of, we talk a lot about magnets, rare earth magnets, which are amazing and you should never let your kids play with, because if you eat them, they get in your digestive tract and it's a disaster. But they are kind of cool to play with if you get to play with them as an adult and don't eat them. But the, you know, there are other sensors and other applications that are incredibly important in electronics. So what China has done is if you want to use their rare earths, which they have all of them, you have to use them within China, right? So that's kind of the control of the downstream activity. And they keep pushing downstream to control more and more of the production and industry associated with the rare earth monopoly. And it's very important strategically for the U.S. to block that, not because I have anything against China. It's just incredibly dumb to have that as a strategic vulnerability and dependence for anybody who actually reads history books. So I think you're going to see DOD make sure that happens.
Yeah.
This is the best deposit in North America. It's also spending a lot of time on mining over my career. The ore body is what matters, right? So this is a good ore body that's very well known, that's very important. So there's very, you know, you're not going to get in there and find the mine plan as a disaster because there are, you know, aspects of this that are, it's been studied for decades. Mm-hmm. So I think there's very much a mission to break that stranglehold on the rare earth downstream activity.
Yeah, there's another theme wrapped in and around this, and it's interesting because it's wrapped around EOS as well. I mean, they've definitely got a Department of Defense angle that plays to their favor, and that's what it is. We have nationalism, or if you want to call it this, something war with the Chinese, where we're just going to try to bring it all home again. And at the end of the day, I wonder, like, you know, how many more companies are going to just be explicit recipients of that? Is that something when institutional subscribers of ours or prospective institutional clients, when you have your initial discussions with them on anything from, hey, the grid is not going to be Chinese, you know, in EO's case, and we've already talked about rare earths, is that their angle? Is that their theme? Is that a generally obvious theme that even I can conclude at this point?
Well, I think you've seen supply chains move out of China because China got expensive for labor. There are a lot of hassles of operating in China. You end up with, you know, weeks of inventory on boats. It can be, you could just as an individual imagine going to China and trying to set up a factory as a joint venture with the local Chinese we'll call him a bureaucrat. And you know, there are a lot of issues that come up, and it's a lot better today, but there are intellectual property theft. I remember I was sitting around with the Danaher used to own this company Fluke that makes the voltmeters, you know, that they're yeah. yellow, digital multimeters, and they're the dominant brand. And like, there were all these knockoffs that were yellow multimeters in China when they switched production there. And I think like one was named Puke, which was very funny, or that was the joke, whatever. They, you know, but they basically, there's a lot of intellectual property theft, a lot of supply chain control problems that come out of operating in China. And now, and you used to get the labor cost advantage, but now it's usually cheaper to just source stuff in Mexico with less risk. And I think the pandemic probably furthers that a little bit. People want more near sourcing. It's good for KSU, the railroad. There's a lot of reasons to produce in, your own geography, beyond even just the sort of defense aspects of it and tariffs.
Yeah, tariffs, national defense, security, big macro themes. Okay, this question just gets right to the point. And actually, Randall from Oakland, I just want to give you a heads up, because this is not how we think about it. It's a little bit old wall in terms of how he asked it. He's asking basically for a 3 and 6 month price target for both Mountain Pass and EOS, and he's asking, I like this part of it, asking for 3,700 fellow followers. Answer the question in terms of what you think these things could be worth, and also just answer the question on why we don't fix ourselves on 3 to 6 month durations. I mean, the thing could be worth that tomorrow. I mean, it's not, that's my simple answer, but go ahead.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that way. It's very rigid, and it's a good way to get yourself run over.
Price targets, right? I mean, that's why the old wall has them, because they have to have them. But it's not, what happens when it goes through your price target? You raise your price target. It doesn't, that's not the way that the buy side or any real investor thinks about it, unless you're there's trying to, have some CYA type thing where the analyst comes in and says, here's my price target. And guess what? Usually when an analyst sells on and his or her price target, that's a very bad decision, because they're A, selling a winner, and B, not letting their winners run, which is one of the biggest problems that investors have over time. They cut their winners short, and they let their losers run. So that's the best way to become a loser, as opposed to becoming a winner in this game. But again, I'm ranting a bit. Go ahead.
No, I think that's exactly right. We had, when we did the FAC MP materials call, we had a very experienced chairman of a public company on our best ideas list, and he was on the call, and he called me after. Nothing inappropriate. He's just sort of like a friendly, a person on distro. And he's like, this stock is going to go to 50. And you're just like, yeah, that's probably right. Like, it probably will go something like 50, because it fits all these criteria of, social investing. And it's very hard to value, but it could be worth a lot, right? You can put valuation ratios on. I think it's good to ground yourself to some kind of a reasonable valuation framework, so you don't end up buying Nikola at 70 or wherever people are buying it. But, I do think that there is an element to being nimble for take and sparity, which you, I think correctly, added in real-time alerts. That's a winner for us. That's up, I think, at least, what got to be up like at least 50, 100% relative to the market. But, when you look back at these names, they typically double or triple relative to the market when they're in their up cycle. If I'm right, it's the up cycle. Why would I run away now, aside to put out an email that makes me look smart or whatever, right? So I do think that framework is very destructive. So first, just on the first cut, it needs to be market relative, right? If the market doubles, everything's going to double, right? Like, it's just, you need to be a little bit flexible for the environment that you're in.
Yeah.
Secondly, when you get new information, you need to respond to that, right? So you want to be flexible in terms of basically adapting your model to new information, with a grounding in a reasonable valuation framework. Like, it isn't reasonable to value Mountain Pass at $1 trillion, but you can look at the ore deposit. You can make some efforts about what eventual capacity would be, and say they move into some downstream magnets. That's a very big market. And eventually you can talk yourself into basically a lot of different numbers, right? But I think it is good to ground yourself and to say, like, okay, for me, I'm fine selling Mountain Pass at 25, right? that's fine. And somebody else can have that alpha if they want it. But that's a big return for me. I think that's where it starts to get stretched, 30, something like that. And, you know, you can change your mind or whatever, but that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. How about EOS? Where do you think it would be stretched?
I think, you know, I think sort of in the 18 to 25 range mm-hmm. is sort of how we did it in the deck. Although EOS is one of these names where every time I look at it, so first time I looked at EOS, I hate this. It's a battery, right? Come on. And then you start looking, you're like, you know, we talked to like a grid operator and they're super excited about it. And they're like, it's really good when the batteries don't explode and catch on fire and kill people. And I'm like, yeah, I guess it is really good, right? You would rather have that battery. And then you start looking around at the battery competition. You're like, this battery competition is horrible. Like there are all these flow batteries where you lose half the energy. Like, why would you put that in there? And, you know, you kind of go and so every time I look at it, I like it more, which I think is usually a good sign for a loan, that people are going to look at it and say, like, oh, this is a big market.
Well, it's also a big cash flow, you know, revenue and cash flow story that's going to manifest with big orders. So, you know, when a company, you know, goes from SPAC to non-SPAC, de-SPAC, what they do is they actually become a real company with real market cap with real cash on the balance sheet. And if you're trying to, you know, solidify a new deal with, you know, your next opportunity, that's a lot easier to do when you don't have everything that I just rattled off. Because people, when they're trying to create, you know, a grid of batteries, they want to bet on the long term, not on a trade. These are right. big infrastructure items that people also are bureaucrats in getting signed off on. Just switching gears here, I know you only have like five more minutes or so. On another thing that you're like, again, Jay's awesome because he can go anywhere here. This one's on ag, and people know that I like ag, and people know that I like inflation. People know that I'll buy pretty much any commodity at this point. Some get annoyed that I call Bitcoin a commodity, so then I'll call it an asset, but an asset's a commodity, so don't get affected by that. But again, David from Texas. Tejas, does an inflationary macro environment smarting? This sounds like David's a very good macro subscriber, macro pro potentially. Does an inflationary macro environment supporting ag commodities historically translate to higher ag-related stocks, i.e. deer? There's another one I want to ask you about, by the way, on this, because we've had some clients asking me on it, and I don't know the answer.
So I think you need to separate the ag environment from, you know, according to different industries. So, for example, you can have the ag chemicals. We had CF Industries as the best idea short because the structure of that industry is incredibly concentrated in the U.S., but it's not a U.S. industry. It's a global industry. And there's a lot of non-economic players in that. So I think for some categories, you know, so basically if Saudi Arabia wants to flare gas or make nitrogen fertilizer, you know, they might make nitrogen fertilizer, in which case, you're going to see oversupply in that. And you see systemic oversupply in a lot of the fertilizer names. In the case of deer, I think it's a very tough call for me. I am bearish on deer and I'm wrong. So that's part of this job is accepting that you're going to get some of the calls wrong. What is concerning about deer is that they are one of the largest creditors to U.S. farmers, right? So they lend more than even most of the ag banks to the U.S. farmer. And if you see the farmer come under pressure, their ability to continue to lend and keep that credit flowing into that market going. So there's, I think, some cycle risk. And I think you're kind of at the low. The cycle turned and it didn't turn back up, right? So I think we got that part of the call correct. I think the part of our process where we fell short on deer is industry structure, that it is such a dominant player within the ag space that it's just very hard for them not to do well. They are this huge lender, right? So they have tremendous ties to the agricultural community. They have a very strong brand. Their products are good. There's a lot of things to like in Deer on that industry structure tab. So the problem for U.S. ag and the dollar play is that Brazil took a lot of market share within the ag export market, which I think has reduced at the margin some of what we would typically see as a driver of strong ag prices. And the other thing that I think people have a problem with in agriculture, maybe I have a problem with this, I don't mean to suggest it's like a dig. It's just that the reference point that people have for the aughts through, say, 2012, of ethanol being a larger portion of gasoline, is probably not representative of where any long-term trend pricing would be, right? Because you had to have acreage expand, the amount of equipment expand. You had, a really unusual and substantial increase in agricultural acreage and agricultural demand to put ethanol into gasoline. So I think people reference off of that environment, and that's probably not the right kind of reference point, because you don't get 10% of gasoline being ethanol very often. That's a very unusual event in agricultural history, where since the 1960s, corn acreage has, mostly trended lower to flat.
All right. Last question, because I know you got to go. Daniel from Connecticut. We couldn't have a conversation here without asking about Tesla. Okay, so thank you, Daniel from Connecticut. I am in Connecticut too, and I am watching the price of Tesla from Connecticut, like I did last time, because I have not really left Connecticut since this whole thing started, because we're not really allowed to. But Tesla today, and he's asking, like, what do you think about it here? Is it going to come back to Earth again? I don't think it's ever actually come back to Earth, but it's interesting, Jay. Like at the same price. It's like looking at the uprights of a field goal. The last time it got to this price was when people were betting, not on Tesla, but on the stock splitting, which was beyond absurd. Now it's going here on another non-fundamental reason, which is a flow reason, which is it's being added to the index. Isn't it amazing, maybe not shocking, that Tesla's all-time high price comes on two things that actually don't have to do with what most people own Tesla for?
Yes. I mean, Tesla is the most remarkable thing about Tesla is its market cap. Like, that is the thing about it that is the most amazing. They are a company that, in my view, principally issues stock. Elon Musk is a person who may become the world's richest man by founding and running a company that has cumulatively lost, I think, $8 billion, right? And, over the last four quarters, generated a profit, but we'll see if it comes out, if they've actually, in a fiscal year, ever earn a profit this January. So, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult stock. It's a fad stock. It's a Robin Hood stock. It's a momentum stock. It is a negative real interest rate stock. It is a stock that generally does terribly in a recovery. So what? Two things. One, a lot of companies historically that look like Tesla but have that parabolic stock price rise, and then a addition to the S&P, that very often, I was tweeting it to much negative feedback, that Yahoo, AOL, Lennar Holmes, a lot of these sort of companies that have this hyperbolic rise in sort of a bubbly or momentum-driven market, the actual like all-time high in the stock is within like a few weeks of S&P addition. So I don't think it's necessarily a bullish catalyst the way I think it's actually a pretty great bearish catalyst. If you were just to do it statistically, like historically, stocks that rose more than 50% and then got added to the S&P, it's a pretty bearish indicator. And it's also just in a quad environment, it's just not a stock that does particularly well in growthier quads, because you're going to look for things like airlines or retailers or whatever that's going to come back and it's going to get you this upside. Whereas, Tesla didn't really have pandemic impact and won't have pandemic recovery. And then the other thing to keep in mind is this is a company that has very few catalysts left, right? So they have introduced their Model Y and that's kind of it. And you see a ton of, in the next three, four quarters, just to be clear, I know that they have other products they're planning to introduce. But if you look at over the next year, how many competing products are coming to market, the conflation of Tesla with electric vehicle is about to be broken. Like around here where I am, pandemic home in Connecticut, there are a ton of e-trons. People really have embraced, other electric cars. You have a whole VW line. You have the Electrify America is now, I think, half the size of the Tesla charging network. So I think you're looking at a much more competitive environment. And the election was an important moment in the U.S. for Tesla, right? Because their tax credit is expired. When I buy an e-tron, I get $7,500 tax credit. If I buy a Model Y, I don't. $7,500 is a lot of money on a car. you know, that was expected to kind of be reversed in, by the election. We'll see how the Senate comes out. But, you know, they're probably likely to remain at a tax credit disadvantage. So it's not a great setup. And I'm surprised, obviously surprised, the stock has been as strong as it has been. There's no particular reason for that other than people have a lot of really creative ideas about Tesla.
Well, I went back to shorting it after it peaked in August on the splits. I mean, it was a pretty good time. Anytime, by the way, that you get a VIX breakout or a NASDAQ volatility breakout like we did, you could have shorted pretty much anything that everybody owned and made money. It's the number one holding in the Goldman hedge fund hotel ETF, the GVIP Tesla. It's the number one holding in ARK, ARKK. It's a huge momentum stock, and it actually was a great short up until a relative short. It actually made money on it from August, from the high there, until that announcement. And that's a wonderful thing, like to look at this again with just a nice white piece of paper, start all over again. And if, by the way, if you want to be long Tesla, because we're not sure, we're still trying to figure out what, you know, if it's Tesla the auto company or it's Tesla the battery company. From here, we would much prefer to be long EOS the battery company than Tesla the battery company, would we not?
Yeah, I think a lot of ESG companies will feel the same way. But I think way to understand Tesla is it is a company that issues stock. Its primary product is Tesla stock. Their best performing product by far has been Tesla stock. And you should assume that when they're hosting an investor day or they're explaining their business, that what they're planning to do is sell you some stock. And when you understand it in that context, I think you'll see that they're a tiny automaker. That their solution for grid storage is not very good. Their solar panels tend to destroy. You know, there's a lot of very fundamental problems with the Tesla business underneath that, you know, don't mesh with the fact that what they're trying to do is sell you stock.
I love that. I love that. And I love Jay Van Sciver. I had to say that, man. I love you, man. You know, that's a great conversation. We've never told each other that, you know, but eventually in a relationship, you get there. And, thanks to all of you for spending the time with us, listening in on our conversation. I love talking to Jay Van Sciver. Pay attention to what he's talking about. He can talk about a lot of different things, and he's been making people a lot of money in his stock picks this year. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.